Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 421st episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta.
I'm feeling a little anemic. Can you help me out, Mike?
Well, I can, James. Actually, that was a Tools for Practice not too long ago.
I did not know that. This is, I mean, talk about...
What a surprise.
What are the chances of that? Like 50-50?
It's very fortuitous that you should bring it up.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. So this is a Tools for Practice that Sam Moe, who works for the National College as well, Sam and I worked on this. And she did the yeoman's work. I just jumped on at the end to claim credit.
Yeah. As always, you were just the pretty face.
Yeah, that's me. A face made for radio. Mm-hmm. This was the question which, you know, if you've been in practice any time in the last 10 years, these new iron formulations have come along. They're either heme iron polypeptides and iron polysaccharide complexes. Or the kind of old ones that we traditionally use, the ferrous salt ones.
Yeah. And in fact, I think some of these sort of newish ones have been around for even much longer than that.
I know. Yeah. I know they have, James, but I'm old enough that I lose track of time now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
In fact, when did we start this podcast?
Yeah, it's our first one, so just keep going.
Keep going. So these, and they have been marketed exceptionally well. And in fact, when you... if you're in the kind of academic teaching world, you'll see that a lot of the guidelines, conversations around this, committees, meetings, and educational events talk about the benefits of choosing the newer irons over the older irons. And yet, I don't recall ever taking a really close examination of the evidence to support those beliefs. So that's exactly what... Sam and I did. So there are actually not as many, despite the huge number of different iron formulations, there's not that many studies, particularly in populations that are most relevant to us. So kind of the general population of adults. There is one RCT of 80 patients, 92% were women, and the mean age is 39. So in that age group, we would expect the vast majority to be female because that's where it's incredibly common, anemia. And this was an iron polysaccharide called Nifrex. Now, don't get confused because Nifrex is a trade name that's used all over the world, and different ones use different formulations. What is Nifrex, the brand name here might be different than Nifrex in Europe, might be different than Nifrex in Asia and within each country. So
I was going to say, and talk about driving everyone crazy, right? Because it's the same thing applies that brand names don't necessarily always mean the same thing. Like there's so many other examples, especially in things like this, like sort of medications that are, I'm not saying they're all over the counter, but even over the counter medications, the brand name can be identical and contain different things because the regulation doesn't deal with that issue.
No, it doesn't at all. In fact, so this type, if you're deeply concerned, which I know someone like you would be, James.
Oh, yes,
this is a polysaccharide ferroglycine combination. Now, I'm sure that helps clear everything up in your mind.
Oh, yeah. Now I know what you're talking about. Before, I was a bit confused.
So this is versus ferrous fumarate. Mm-hmm. Both were given at the equivalent of 150 milligrams per day of elemental iron.
Which is typically the dose that people recommend for people who are anemic. And we can maybe talk about that in a little bit, whether you need all that. But that's the typical dose of elemental iron that people recommend.
Right. And we'll get to that. In young women... And when I say young women, 39 would be included. It's probably not unreasonable, particularly studies done in 20s and 30s. But in older adults, this probably would be overkill. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, looking at ferrous fumarate, it improved hemoglobin by 28 points versus iron polysaccharide, which improved things 6 points. So not, so the newer agent was not better at all. Mm-hmm. And serum ferritin, mean corpuscle volume, transferrin level or saturation level were all better with the old ferrous fumarate rather than the new iron. The ferrous fumarate did have more nausea, 31% versus 3%. So that's not a small amount, but no, it's also working much more efficiently. Let's talk about the next study, which is 80 children. So the number is 80 again, but this is a mean age of 23 months. And they were iron polysaccharide. This time, the trade name was Novoferrin. And it was versus ferrous sulfate. And both were given at, remember, because these are little guys, this is 3 milligrams per kilogram per day of elemental iron. And at 12 weeks, ferrous sulfate improved hemoglobin 10 more units than the newer iron. And they set a target of resolving iron deficiency anemia. And they the old iron, the ferrous sulfate, attained that in 29% of patients versus 6% of patients attained it in the new iron group. So that's a difference of about 23% in a number needed to treat of around 5. Ferrous sulfate did cause more diarrhea. So, the elemental iron caused more diarrhea. So 35% in the ferrous sulfate group versus 58%. So where in the first one we saw a better, quite a bit better activity, but slightly worse adverse events. And this one we saw better activity and a reduction of adverse events with the older irons. There are two smaller trials, one in adults and one in premature infants. Size of the trials is 43 and 32. And there was no difference in hemoglobin improvement after 4 to 6 weeks in either one of those two studies. They were both quite small and likely not to tease out too many differences anyhow. So that's kind of the general population research showing that at best, the new irons in one study caused a little bit less nausea, but overall were less effective and in a second study caused more adverse events. So not really promising, Dr. No. McCormick.
No, and you gotta wonder with that, does it have something, at least for the first study, the thought is maybe, you know, the amount of iron that people are being exposed to or absorbing or whatever is more with the older agents versus the newer agents. And that maybe that's why you don't get the same hemoglobin improvement, but you'll get more GI effects because you're getting exposed to it. But with that second trial, it showed even less side effects with the older ferrous sulfate. And
yeah, I know.
So it's a bit, it is kind of confusing, but certainly none of this in any way, shape or form, especially given the popularity of these and the push to use these. I mean, that it's, the evidence is so incredibly weak. I mean, if I was looking at this, I would say, if you're trying to decide between the Niferex or the ferrous fumarate, and I would probably just give a less ferrous fumarate. And you probably
would get, if you're concerned about the adverse events,
or at least start low, you know, versus going at 150 milligrams, start with maybe a third of that. And if they can tolerate it, great, you might be able to go up. But, you know, even if you reduce this dose by a third, you might even get the same hemoglobin response because it was quite a bit more with the older agent.
Oh, for sure. It was a big difference. And then just some of the subgroups that have been examined. Two studies looked at dialysis patients over 6 months, and ferrous salts were no different than the newer formulations in the transferrin saturation or the proportion of iron replete patients. One of the studies found that ferritin improved more with ferrous sulfate than it did with the heme iron called trade name Proferrin ES. Mm-hmm. So again, if anything, it's hinting that the older irons are better. Looking at a tiny study of post-gastric bypass patients, so the number in there is 14, so a very tiny study, mm-hmm. over 8 weeks. Ferrous sulfate improved hemoglobin over baseline at 8 weeks, but heme iron did not. Again, showing that, if anything, shying away from the new irons. Mm-hmm. And then two other studies, one of blood donors with 97 patients and another one of pregnant patients with 90 of them, compared heme iron with ferrous fumarate and found no difference from higher doses of ferrous fumarate alone in achieving anemia outcomes. Ferrous fumarate alone did lead to more constipation.
Yeah. So in that sort of select group, the blood donors and pregnant patients, they got a similar anemia response in contrast to the general population in adults that we talked about before, but very similar cause, more GI effects. There's sort of a, 20-25% more people had GI side effects, which is what we see with elemental iron.
Right, exactly. So really, if you take all of this into collection, you could certainly not say that the new irons were any better at improving any of the markers of anemia, whether it's, the actual hemoglobin itself, whether it's the ferritin, like the iron stores, or other markers like transferrin saturation, that kind of thing. None of those are improving. And only in a couple studies were the adverse events actually worse with the newer irons. There's there's a study where they were better with the older irons, and they were, or they're the same. So given that collection of things, we just could not figure out. It clearly boils down to excellent marketing.
Yeah, no, it certainly sounds like it, because even there's really nothing even teasing us that it's better.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's without us getting into the limitations of the studies and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, it's really, and it's amazing that with limited information, we shouldn't be amazed, and I don't think neither of us are really amazed, because we see it all the time, that you can, push so hard with these sorts of things, despite the lack of overwhelming evidence.
Yeah, and this is not the first time this has ever been discovered in the medical literature. There's a great article from two decades ago or something like that, looking at how the prescribing of kind of the original calcium channel blockers, diltiazem, verapamil, that kind of thing, ended up increasing when the data was coming out that they weren't working.
Right.
So prescribing, even though the data was consistently, studies were coming out showing it's not really working for the treatment of hypertension and that kind of thing, but prescribing was going up, and it showed that the biggest predictor was the marketing influence, because as negative studies came out, more and more pressure was put on marketing to drive sale of those, and that actually is what made them more heavily prescribed. I mean, we debated about doing a top studies one and talking about the diabetes thing, and how many times have we talked about drugs that have very little effect, like DPP-4s, and yet DPP-4s are the most commonly prescribed or the most expensive diabetes drug that we have right now, because it's prescribed so much, not because it's the most expensive, but it's the most we're paying provincially, and yet it doesn't really work to do anything. And so it's clearly marketing.
That never stops people from using these things.
No,
and,
never.
And as Mike was talking, go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead. No.
No, and Mike was saying, we were debating about what to do for this podcast. And one of the things that we were going to talk about there's been three new diabetes trials. And for those of you been following along for 420 episodes, we talk a lot about these, and we almost couldn't stomach talking about another three studies in type 2 diabetes, which is a great
pancreas couldn't take it.
Yeah, which is a great segue. So anyway, I'll just give you there were three trials. I'm not going to talk about the data and everything, but there was a GLP dulaglutide, and that was in the Rewind trial. There was Pioneer 6, which is an oral GLP, which is semaglutide, and then a trial of a drug that's actually already had a large trial done called canagliflozin, but it was this was where they were looking at in patients with albuminuric kidney disease. Nice thing about it, they all showed positive results in that there weren't worse outcomes, and there were some reductions in some of the important outcomes. But if you really want to know the results, Mike,
I would go to my studies. I don't know where
as,
you would
as you there. Should as you should. We and this is the segue is that we just made the mystudies.org completely free to anyone who wants to go use it. And what it is a it's where we've taken probably the top, I don't know, 300 or so cardiovascular trials and made a short synopsis where you can get access to every number, all of the numbers needed to treat, all of the confidence intervals and what was positive, what was negative. And it's really all the important cardiovascular trials from probably the last 40 years, roughly. And so rather than us going over all of those studies, I'd encourage you guys to go look.
Which would be fun.
We would make it, it would be spellbinding.
Captain, riveting. Oh, you couldn't pull yourself away.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things we'd suggest is just for something else to do rather than just listening to podcasts, go to mystudies.org and just look at all the studies that are there and just click on those and you'll get all the numbers. And it's a great way of looking at all of the data around drugs for type 2 diabetes, for cholesterol and blood pressure and so on. So that's the segue that we went into there. But let's just wrap up the iron.
I was also going to say those studies also serve as an excellent treatment for insomnia. In fact, in head-to-head comparisons versus sobaclone, they clearly come out as superior.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt. Now, it's weird. In that study, it also caused constipation. We don't know why.
The fact is, and you know this as well as I do, if you had enough patients, and you looked at enough outcomes, you could likely cause one of those adverse events. Yeah. Anyhow, let's
put the iron stuff into context.
Okay, so first of all, these studies were, often grossly underpowered. As we mentioned, one had 14 people in it.
Yeah, but the other ones were
the 80s. No, that's actually quite reasonable, as you
and they because they did show actually differences in side effects. So there you go.
Yeah. And then all of them had multiple outcomes: transferrin level, the size of the red blood cells, the number of hemoglobin, hematocrit, you name it. And a lot of them were non-intention to treat because they would start the study and then only end up having measured outcomes on smaller groups of patients. So it was a per protocol.
Yeah. And the outcome was a lab value. It wasn't, did the patients feel better? Now they did the side effects, which is important, but they're not looking at, do you feel better?
Yeah, no, there's virtually no real patient oriented outcomes here, except maybe adverse events.
Yeah.
But still, even if you take all of that and recognize that these are on new products, so likely funded by manufacturers, and they still can't seem to find much benefit, I think the results are still practice changing.
Yeah.
If you were leaning towards these newer agents. So the approximate cost of these at somewhere around 100 milligrams of elemental iron a day for 1 month is, if you're looking at the classic ferrous salts, it's somewhere between $5 and $15 a month, and that's for ferrous sulfate, gluconate, or fumarate, often kind of at the lower end of that range. The newer irons, things like iron polysaccharide complex called Ferramax, it's around $35 for the month. For ferrous fumarate, called Palifer, is one of the trade names, it's $35. And then there's one called Proferrin, which is a heme iron polypeptide, and it's around $105 a month. These costs are approximate. They change all the time, but they give you context for comparison. And then there's options that you can do if you want to kind of look at reducing total adverse events. Using a lower dose has been studied. It was studied in, it's been studied a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. In younger females, kind of in that 20 age group, it has been shown that to actually increase hemoglobin levels, you need to, and iron stores, you need to use higher doses in them. So the kind of 100 to 150 we were talking about, but that does lead to more adverse events. In trials of elderly people, using a lower dose did not impact the amount of hemoglobin increase at all, mm-hmm. but did significantly and meaningfully, like a 20% absolute reduction in adverse events leading to discontinuation. So that means one in five more patients will actually stay on the intervention by using a lower dose. Yeah. So I think that's important.
Yeah, and I would suggest that regardless of, like you said, it may be worthwhile if you can get up to the 100 or 150 milligrams a day. But usually there's no urgency. Like, it's not like you need it today and it won't work today anyway. But you might want to say, mm-hmm. you know, about a third of people will get upset, you know, sort of upset GI events. And it probably is worth, you know, starting with a third of that dose and give it to them for a day or two, make sure they tolerate it. Otherwise, it's just, you know, it's like when, you know, when you use erythromycin and it causes GI events, it's, you know, they sometimes the cure is worse than the disease.
Yeah, for a lot of people on erythro.
Yeah. And you need to let people know that it might do that. And, you know, the other approach is go, you know, we want to use 100 or 150 milligrams. But if it starts, if you don't tolerate it and it makes your stomach upset, please immediately reduce the dose.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And so you can do that too by not just reducing dose, but using it on alternate days if you're getting bigger dose tablets.
Yeah.
And then, as we said before, dividing it out, kind of spreading it throughout the day might help. The other thing you can do is ferrous glucate and ferrous sulfate seem to have slightly less adverse events than ferrous fumarate. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to switch, and generally at a same dosing range, like ferrous gluconate 300 versus ferrous fumarate 300, there's a lot more elemental iron in the fumarate. So that would explain likely the increase in adverse events. But it's kind of 30-35% chance versus 45-50% chance. So you can see the adverse events are higher in the ferrous fumarate. Yeah. But it just gives you some options.
And I was going to say, I know I've looked at those studies and it's always tricky because they often, it's not always head-to-head comparisons.
Oh,
And sometimes you use different ultimate doses of elemental iron and all. It's really tricky. But I think you can pretty much roughly say around a third.
So I do that. I find that if I have patients on some of the, like a ferrous fumarate, and they're really finding the adverse events and we've tried to decrease, I'll often switch them to ferrous gluconate as a trial to see if that can help. And I think all of us do that, right?
When
patients are having adverse events, let's try another pill too if we can't find a good compromise another way.
Yeah. Or just start off with ferrous gluconate or sulfate.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's what I ended up doing as my career progressed, because I was concerned about the ferrous fumarate adverse events. But you can see from these clinical trials we reviewed that it is definitely more effective. It's either the same or better than any of the newer irons. So important to remember.
Yeah. So you won't be being asked by the companies to give talks, I don't think.
No, not anytime soon.
Yeah.
Some last things we do need to note. So, you know, older patients who are anemic definitely need investigations for why they're anemic. And even men shouldn't be losing iron. So if they're anemic and not giving blood and not having a reason for a low iron, then they need to be investigated as to why.
Oh, for sure.
So that's probably one of the key things. We don't want to just go ahead and treat, you know, a 55-year-old with low iron and low hemoglobin, thinking that we can just restore these, because we actually have to find out why they're low, because it could be catastrophic.
So. Yeah, no, exactly. So we've tried to sell mystudies.org, which I hope which is selling is a bit of a trick because we're not charging for it.
Yeah, that's right.
But anything else you want to sort of let people know about?
Yeah, so we'll just wrap up this. So newer iron formulations appear to be inferior to the older ferrous salts. The ferrous salts improve hemoglobin 10 to 20 grams per liter more, and about 1 in 5 more will attain iron deficiency anemia, resolution of iron deficiency anemia after 3 months. And the newer formulations, whether they have less adverse events, we're really not sure. The data is quite inconsistent, so you can't say that to support them either. As far as what I have to sell, I think we've mentioned this before. The National College is doing a webinar series, and that occurs almost every month. We're taking a break for August for summer, but we're back again in September to look at the top 10 articles from the journal Canadian Family Physician, which is our journal. And the peer group is diligently working on a new pain piece, right, James? We're working on osteoarthritis right now. We should have that out sometime in the fall, but it's still a little ways away.
Yeah, and by that you mean we're putting together a guideline where we don't tell you what to do, but we give you the best available evidence and
these will be probably best considered. They're going to be systematic reviews with some knowledge translation pieces with them. Yeah. There'll be three of them. Osteoarthritis, then neuropathic pain, back pain, then neuropathic pain, updating our calculator, our pain calculator, mm-hmm. and then inevitably working on a guideline on how you kind of in primary care approach pain management. But the foundational piece is about options for the management of each of those three primary pain conditions we're going to be dealing with in these knowledge translation pieces. And I think they're coming along nicely, James, but...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's an awful lot of work, and we got a good team behind us. And again, Mike and I are just the pretty faces, so there you go.
Yeah. All right, I think if we're selling that, then we're desperate.
Yeah, so. It's time to... So I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.